Hi, this is Daniel Garb of the Movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Roy Cohn is an historical phenomenon many people hate, despise, or fear. In his lifetime, he sent Ethel and Julius Rosenberg to the electric chair, worked beside Joe McCarthy in the massive government purge of the left, persecuted homosexuals, defended right-wing causes, mentored Donald Trump, and defended the mob. Behind the scenes, he lived a decadent gay life. He was also a devious, ruthless, and very powerful lawyer who ruled in New York City, prompting more than one person to ask, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" Where is My Roy Cohn is also the name of a new documentary that chronicles the notorious man's life. It shares photos, recordings, period footage, and interview with some of his closest friends, family, and past lovers. The film was directed by Matt Turnauer, known for his documentaries on the folk heroes and villains of our time. From Scotty Bowers to Jane Jacobs to Robert Moses, Where is My Roy Cohn? Opens today in Toronto at the TIFF Bell Lightbox, and I'm very pleased to have Matt Turnauer here by telephone to tell us more about Roy Cohn. Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for calling.
Good to be here.
We spoke 2 years ago at TIFF about Scotty and the Secrets of Hollywood, so it's great to talk to you again. So Roy Cohn has been well known since the 1950s, but younger people nowadays mainly know him just as a character played by Al Pacino in Angels in America. So give some background and tell me about what he was like first as a child growing up.
Roy Cohn was from a very wealthy Jewish family in New York City. He was born in 1927. The family controlled huge companies, Bank of the United States, which was the big Jewish bank of the era, Phillips Bent Hughes and Schertz, an enormous company, Lionel Trains, which is immortal, and Q-tips. The family held the patent on Q-tips. So it was a very privileged upbringing. And he is the son of the heiress, Dora Marcus, and Al Cohn, who became a judge. And this is an origin story that the family, where Cohn's family, seizes on. It was an arranged marriage and a loveless marriage. Dora Cohn was a difficult woman who didn't have good looks but a lot of money and was not getting married at the appropriate age. So the family made this young lawyer, Al Cohn, a judge. And out of this union came an only child, and that's Roy Cohn. His family, three of whom I interview in the film, despise him, more or less, as do many Americans. But within the Cohn family, there's a search for the origin of a man whom they consider to be a monster.
So his first big case, he graduated from Columbia Law School at age 20 before he could even write the bar. But his first landmark case was Ethel and Julius Rosenberg.
Yes, so he's 23 at the time, a young lawyer, and because of family connections, and also drive and ambition on his own part, he lands this spot on the prosecution team of what they were called the Adam Spies at the time, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. And the team of prosecutors was Jewish, and the judge was Jewish, and this was very purposeful on the part of the Justice Department. They wanted to avoid charges of an anti-Semitic prosecution, and they found Jewish lawyers to take up the case. Cohn was in many ways the most vehement on the prosecution team, and he had family connections with the judge, whose name was Irving Kaufman, who was also from an upper-class Jewish background. And Kaufman was apparently mesmerized by this young lawyer, Cohn, and would listen to him. So Roy Cohn wanted to make his name on this case, and he realized by going to the extreme and assuring the Rosenbergs, the electric chair, especially Ethel, who really was not guilty, and there was no evidence of her guilt, but still the demagoguing of supposed communists in that era was prevalent and could get you popular support. Cohn convinced Kaufman to give Ethel the electric chair, and both of the Rosenbergs were killed at Sing Sing prison. And it was a very traumatic moment for the left in the United States and for the Jewish community and for many people, because it was considered to be overreach.
And it led him directly to the McCarthy hearings, which he served as the legal backup for Joe McCarthy, along with David Shine. Could you talk about that unusual relationship?
Yeah, so in hindsight, all of these things are on a continuum. Cohen succeeds in becoming famous in legal circles and also socially prominent in the Rosenberg period. Remember, he's just 23. Then J. Edgar Hoover, the infamous head of the FBI, who was an anti-communist crusader and also homosexual, but in the closet, handpicks Cohen to be McCarthy's chief counsel in the Senate subcommittee, which is now better known as the Communist Witch Hunt Committee of McCarthy. And Cohen then becomes nationally famous because McCarthy was a demagogue and loved the cameras, and the cameras loved to cover him. And the whole point of his witch hunts was to gain publicity and fame. He had no real beliefs, and Cohen was, in a way, his whisperer, his demagogue whisperer. Cohen, a young gay man at the time, but again, totally in secret, developed a crush on a tall, handsome, rich boy whose name was David Shine. He got David Shine a job on the McCarthy subcommittee as kind of his assistant. So there was this strange troika of this period, these two young men, Cohen and Shine, and then McCarthy, who was, you know, this incendiary figure and a really dangerous, poisonous demagogue. It shook down into what was called the Army-McCarthy hearing in 1954, which actually ended up being a show trial, a media spectacle at the dawn of television, with Roy Cohn and this young man, David Shine, at the center. Because many Americans just don't remember this, but the whole point of those hearings was Cohn wanted this pretty boy who was inducted into the Army as a private to get a promotion as a general. Preposterous on its face, but that was what his demand was. And he called the Secretary of the Army and demanded a promotion, and he demanded a posting at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in the penthouse. So the Army said no to him, rightfully so, and he then said, well, I'm going to wreck the Army, and he convinced McCarthy to go on a witch hunt to try to bring down the Army and bring charges of communist infiltration. And that led to this trial in the U.S. Senate called the Army-McCarthy hearings, where Cohn and McCarthy are kind of put on trial for trying to undermine and smear the Army. And it went on for more than 30 days, and 20 million people watched it. And it ended up bringing down McCarthy and bringing down Cohn as well, except McCarthy died in 2 years and was censured by the U.S. Senate. Cohn came back, and then begins the second act, where he reinvents himself as a power broker, mafia attorney, and eventually inventor of Donald Trump as a lawyer in New York City.
So let's talk about that. He's reported to have mentored Trump as he defended him and his father in the discriminatory public housing case. But here's what he said, apparently: never admit you're wrong. If they attack you, counterattack viciously. And if you're in trouble, sue, distract, divert attention, which could be, we can see that every single day in the newspapers with Trump. So talk about this, and talk about, in particular, Roy Cohn's lies along the way.
Yes, well, the other thing he frequently said was double down. And if you've been watching the news today, Trump doubled down on this enormous scandal involving Ukraine, and now he asks China to prosecute candidate Joe Biden, or investigate him, rather, which is classic Roy Cohn tactic, doubling down in public and making a huge diversionary circus Cohn meets Trump in the early 70s when Trump's a young kind of outsider real estate developer. His father is a major owner of apartments in the outer boroughs. And they're being sued by the Justice Department for housing discrimination. They weren't letting African Americans rent in their building, and they were rightfully being prosecuted. Trump hired Cohn to defend them, and he brought them to a point where they settled without an admission of guilt, which in another Roy Cohn postulate, Trump used to declare victory. It wasn't a victory. It was at most a draw, but this is the Roy Cohn tactic is when you lose, just declare victory and do it as loudly as possible in the media, and it will have a salutary effect, which it generally does. So all through his early career in the 70s and 80s, Cohn is at Trump's side fixing things for him. He is the lawyer for the mafia dons in New York. And that's a very useful connection to have because the construction industry, which is what Trump wanted to get into in Manhattan, building Trump Tower most famously, is controlled, or was, it's certainly controlled by the mafia in that period. And you could do things much more easily if you had the path cleared and mafia connections, which Cohn certainly had. So there were lots of favors that Cohn did for Trump, and he really saw him as a final project and a protege, if you will, an apprentice in his last years. Cohn dies of AIDS in 1986 and is a broken man, really. He was disbarred in the last weeks of his life, and he had really no friends anymore. They had all abandoned him in this very dark final act of his life. Trump also retreated from him, which is ironic because no one has much nice to say about Cohn. He, and obviously his impact on the world is enormous right now as Trump virtually channels him every day. I would go so far as to say that Cohn created a president from beyond the grave. But one thing people do say about Cohn that could be considered a virtue is that he was loyal to his friends. And it seems like Trump wasn't even able to pull that off, and he distanced himself from Cohn, who was certainly loyal to him all through their lives.
Your most recent film before this one was about Studio 54, which is like a palace of decadence, drugs, and sex in the disco era. This is before his downfall and death, but Roy Cohn was a regular there. How could he live a public life and keep all his secrets private at the same time?
Yeah, so Cohn was the lawyer for Studio 54, which was, you've described it perfectly with those three adjectives. It was also a very gay environment because gay culture in the late 70s in New York was really dominant, and the studio was a center of it. Cohn was right there every night, virtually. And having made films and written about society and the role of sexuality in our modern society, Studio 54 is one of those. Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood is another. But what I've found is that people could have open secrets at a certain time. This was really at the dawn of what then was called gay liberation. There really wasn't a gay movement until there was anything very strong or noticeable until the 70s. And people still were living lives in the closet, and sometimes somewhat open lives that just weren't really clocked by the general public. And it's a strange phenomenon today because we live in a time of much more openness, but homosexuality was so unmentionable and so discouraged in what was considered to be polite conversation at the time that if people were gay and even slightly open about it, though in the closet, it generally didn't come into family discussions or family newspapers, as they used to be called. The word gay wasn't printed in the New York Times, I think, until the 80s. Wow. It just was almost an unmentionable topic. So people could kind of slip by or pass and live double lives, even somewhat open double lives. It's a quite a interesting phenomenon that's been mostly wrung out of our culture because we're encouraged to live lives in the open now, and people come out and things are generally much better, at least in big urban areas. But at that time, it was a very different picture.
And finally, very quickly, there seems to be a big appetite for supervillains now. The movie The Joker is coming out today. If Roy Cohn were a supervillain, who do you think he would be?
Roy Cohn was a supervillain.
He doesn't need a cartoon one.
I would put him up against the Joker. I mean, in a Godzilla-Rodan scenario, I'm not sure who would win that, actually. And it's a very good observation. Movies reflect the culture sometimes not in obvious ways. You know, film noir was prevalent in the post-war era, which had lots of dark undercurrents, much of them brought on by the McCarthy era, and film noir trafficked in those scenes. And I would say that movies like The Joker and other larger-than-life villainous yarns probably have to do, in many ways, with what we now unfortunately have to call Trumpism and this type of really dark, dirty, demagogic politics.
Thanks so much for talking with me. Matt Turnauer, Matt Turnauer's new documentary, Where Is My Roy Cohn, opens today in Toronto with a TIFF Bell Lightbox. This is Daniel Garber, the movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.